financial information firm owned by New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. As EOP had hoped, on November 24th, Vornado President Michael Fascitelli contacted EOP's banker, Doug Sessler, at Merrill Lynch to say Vornado was considering an offer. Yet, bizarrely, EOP would hear nothing more from Vornado for weeks. Zell grew alarmed. He had read newspaper reports about a Department of Justice investigation of possible collusion among buyout firms in bidding wars, and began to wonder if Blackstone was freezing out competitors. When Gray arranged a get-to-know-you meeting with Zell over coffee one day, when Zell was passing through New York, he found himself on the receiving end of a tirade from Zell, whom he hardly knew. For the sake of his career, Zell told Gray, he better not be doing anything to stifle rival bids. "No fucking around," Zell told him, employing a lot of colorful language, as Zell recalls it. The clear, unequivocal point was to scare Gray, Zell freely admits. Nothing ever came of the government investigation. The rant rattled Gray, who cultivated a reputation of rectitude, but it did nothing to elicit an offer from Vornado. Finally, in mid-December, Zell called Roth and asked, "Where the hell are you?" Roth confided that he had been tied up in unsuccessful talks with a potential bidding partner. Several more weeks passed without word from Vornado until January 8, 2007, 7 weeks after the Blackstone EOP agreement was announced. Fascitelli rang Sessler to say that Vornado wouldn't bid for EOP after all. Instead, Vornado wanted to speak to Blackstone about buying specific properties. It looked like Blackstone had EOP to itself. A week later, on January 15th, Vornado did an about-face. Fascitelli called to say that Vornado was again weighing a takeover bid. By the morning of the 17th, the markets were rife with rumors that Vornado would soon unveil an offer, and Zell banged out an email to his friend. "Dear Stevie, roses are red, violets are blue. I heard a rumor. Is it true? Love and kisses, Sam." The Vornado side was amused but flummoxed. None of Vornado's executives or bankers or lawyers could come up with a clever rhyme. Finally, Roth made a lame stab at email poetry. "Sam, how are you? The rumor is true. I do love you. And the price is 52. Zell had his auction. "We were obviously thrilled," says Kincaid. The joy soon was tempered when Zell, Kincaid, and the EOP team saw the details of the proposal, which was backed by two other investors, Starwood Capital Group Global and Walton Street Capital. Zell and Kincaid had made it abundantly clear that they wanted a cash bid because they were convinced that real estate stocks like property itself were topping out. If they sold EOP for Vornado shares and the stock fell, EOP shareholders wouldn't have locked in the peak of the market price. Vornado's $38 billion offer, though, was 40% in stock. Moreover, it was non-binding, and Vornado had not yet lined up debt financing as Blackstone had when it signed its deal. To make matters worse, Vornado demanded that EOP sell off assets Vornado didn't want before the deal closed. Finally, for legal reasons, Vornado's own shareholders would have to approve the deal, and it was far from certain that they would agree to Vornado's borrowing more money and issuing so many new shares. Even if it had been a binding offer, there were so many conditions that it was far from a sure thing. It was really just a sketch of a possible deal, and not a very appealing sketch at that. EOP's management made the best of it they could. "Of course, we immediately went back to Blackstone and said it was terrific. Zell says. Vornado's posture was understandable. Vornado's market capitalization was only slightly bigger than EOP's, and it would have had to borrow a lot of money to make an all-cash bid, which likely would have knocked down its stock price. Its stock was trading at an all-time high, and at a much higher earnings multiple than EOP's, so it had every reason to prefer to pay with stock. But Zell had been clear with Roth the previous summer, and was clear in his own mind. He wanted cash, and only cash. You know how when you're in a discussion with your spouse, says one person who was involved in the talks about Roth's bid, sometimes you hear what you want to hear. Zell hadn't managed to ignite the bidding war he expected, but another one was heating up at Blackstone, where the phones were ringing off the hooks. Everyone in the commercial property business was clamoring to pry loose a piece of EOP. Gray and Frank Cohen were caught off guard shortly after the deal was announced, when they had lunch with a property mogul who unexpectedly began to quiz them about what they would sell. None of the men had notepaper. They had to summon a waiter and borrow his order pad to jot down a list of the cities. The inquiries and offers vindicated Blackstone's bet that it could offload assets to finance the buyout. The flood of calls also made it clear to Gray's team that they could sell much more than the one-third or so of EOP's square footage they had projected. The Godfather bids it was receiving for the buildings would make it possible to raise Blackstone's offer for EOP if it needed to. It turned out that it soon would. Just as Blackstone had been forced to boost its bid for Freescale a few months earlier to preempt a firm offer from KKR and Silver Lake, Blackstone found itself under pressure to lift its offer for EOP, even though there was no other binding bid from Vornado on the table. EOP's share price had risen past Blackstone's $48.50 offer, which meant some investors had paid more than that for their stock and wouldn't want to sell at a loss into Blackstone's offer. Blackstone was now bidding against market expectations as much as against Vornado. The solution was to firm up the offers Blackstone was receiving for EOP's buildings, so it could elevate its offer for EOP. To do so, Gray needed permission to share EOP's internal financial information with the real estate firms that wanted pieces of EOP. EOP quickly gave it. Just as in Freescale, Blackstone had the jump on the competition, because it had the support of the Target's board and had access to the Target's internal financial information for months. Vornado had neither, and Blackstone would have to exploit its advantage. Gray's group launched a hectic round of talks, negotiating with real estate firms by day and then convening at night to deal with the EOP side of the deal. It quickly became clear that Blackstone would have to sell far more than one-third of EOP it had planned, but the lofty offers Blackstone was fielding were nearly impossible to refuse. The decisive factor was a jaw-dropping bid from Harry Macklow, a New York office baron who offered to buy most of EOP's New York buildings for $6.6 billion, a cap rate of between 3 and 3.5. That was equivalent to a cash flow multiple of 29 to 33, well into nosebleed territory. Macklow would have to pay more than 3.5% interest on the loans to buy the buildings, so he was guaranteed to lose money, at least in the short run. It made sense only if he could sharply boost the rents he collected, or if the buildings were destined to rise in value. The New York portfolio was one of EOP's jewels, and one of the chief lures to Blackstone in the first place. But Macklow's offer was irresistible. The $6.6 billion would go a long way toward Gray's goal of owning the rump of EOP for far less than its current value, he was now ready to offer EOP a bit more. On January 22nd, Blackstone's bankers told EOP that Blackstone would pay $53.50 a share, a $5 boost over the price they had agreed on in November, provided EOP would increase the breakup fee to $700 million, or 3% of EOP's market capitalization. EOP's board held out for more, and eventually Blackstone agreed to $54 a share and settled for just a $500 million breakup fee. At that level, the fee amounted to $1.40 per share, effectively raising the cost of Vornado by that much. Now it was crucial to keep pressing hard toward the EOP shareholder vote on February 5th, just 11 days away, because Vornado was still posing questions to Kincaid and EOP's advisors. "We had a big timing advantage," says Brian Stadler, one of the two lead lawyers at Simpson, Thatcher, and Bartlett on the deal for Blackstone. "We wanted to keep the momentum." When the Chicago Tribune reported January 31st that Vornado was going to bid $58.50, $4.50 more than Blackstone, the Blackstone team feared that, notwithstanding their push, the game was over. "That was the low point for us," Gray says. But Vornado's next proposal once again fell short of its advance billing. Bidding so low now, Vornado offered just $56 a share, and it lowered the cash portion to 55% from 60%. To Zell and Kincaid, this was not really an improvement, and in some ways was worse than the disappointing January 17th proposal. Roth and Fasciatelli seemed to be haggling, as they might with another real estate firm, over a building sale. They didn't seem to realize they were dealing with the board of a public company that had to have a compelling offer to present to shareholders. For the moment, Blackstone stood pat and didn't up the ante. But EOP's shares continued to rise in anticipation of another round of bidding, and neither Gray nor the EOP executives were confident that shareholders would go for its $54 offer. On Super Bowl Sunday, February 1st, on the eve of the EOP shareholder vote, Gray was at home in Manhattan, glued to the TV, as his hometown team, the Chicago Bears, faced off against the Indianapolis Colts. He had just watched the Bears' Devin Hester run back the opening kickoff for a 92-yard touchdown when word came that Vornado had made another offer. Within minutes, Gray and his fellow Chicagoan Kincaid at EOP were commiserating about the interruption to the game. "Can you believe this?" Gray said to Kincaid. They would miss the rest of the big game trying to figure out what Vornado was up to. As it turned out, the offer was less dramatic than the run back. Vornado had stayed at $56, but offered to buy up to 55% of EOP's outstanding shares in advance of Vornado's shareholder vote. That would guarantee EOP shareholders some cash immediately. But there was a downside. If Vornado's own shareholders voted down the full merger, Vornado would win control of EOP without paying for the whole company, and EOP's investors would be left as minority shareholders. What's more, even this offer was not legally binding. Vornado was free to back out. Vornado's nickel and diming played into Blackstone's hands. "We hoped that Vornado's final bid for EOP would be flawed, riddled with conditions, not legally binding, not all cash. And it was," says James. "When Vornado's proposal was announced, we said, 'Aha, we could really put a stake through the heart of it.' They gave us that opening by their weak half-measure, and we took it." Gray huddled with Schwartzman and James. Blackstone had already been forced to come up 11% from its original $48.50 offer in the fall to $54. Did it make sense to increase its offer again particularly when the Vornado bid seemed so unattractive? Time and again in Blackstone's internal meetings, Schwartzman invoked the memory of KKR's overpaying for RJR Nabisco. "We don't want another RJR," he would tell Gray. "We talked about putting the firm's reputation at risk in so big a deal," Gray said. "If we had overpaid and the deal had gone spectacularly badly, we could have really hurt a franchise that took 20 years to build." But the offers for EOP properties were so high that the leftovers would end up costing Blackstone less than they would have at the original November price, Gray demonstrated to Schwartzman and James. Blackstone went back to EOP and offered another $1.25 or $55.25 a share. EOP's board pushed for an extra 25 cents, and the deal was struck at $55.50, with the breakup fee lifted to $720 million. The buyout would now be worth $38.7 billion, topping RJR Nabisco by an even wider margin than the original deal would have. Vornado folded. 2 days after the shareholder vote, which had been postponed to February 7th, Blackstone owned EOP. Gray's team had no time for a victory dinner. Gray's wife, Mindy, came to his office with a double magnum of Veuve Clicquot and a box of chocolate-covered raisins. The weary dealmaker spent 10 minutes toasting their accomplishment before turning to the daunting task of finalizing $19 billion of property sales they had in the pipeline. The biggest piece was already done. Macklowe's $6.6 billion deal for most of EOP's New York portfolio closed with the main buyout. A $6.4 billion sale of the Washington and Seattle holdings to Beacon Capital, the company headed by Alan Leventhal, whose theories of replacement value had inspired Gray, was nearly in the bag. But EOP emerged from the buyout with $32 billion in debt and the $3.5 billion of equity bridge financing, and knowing how torrid the market was, Gray sensed he had only a small window to sell off what he didn't want to get those numbers down. From February to June, Blackstone unloaded $61 million of EOP's roughly $100 million in square footage for about $28 billion, and was left holding only properties in prime markets. The prices it received were so extraordinary that its effective cost for the remainder was far below their market value. With the benefit of leverage, Blackstone's $3.5 billion equity investment was worth about $7 billion when the sales were complete. It had doubled its money on paper, simply by breaking up EOP. Having pulled off by far the biggest deal Blackstone had ever attempted, Gray, Cohen, and Kaplan could now turn their attention back to Hilton, the company they had been wooing on and off before EOP consumed all their energies. Chapter 22. Going public. Very public. "I'm not going to get beat twice," Schwartzman promised Michael Puglisi, Blackstone's longtime chief financial officer, after KKR raised a $5 billion investment pool on the Amsterdam Stock Exchange in May 2006. That offering demonstrated that public investors were hungry to buy into private equity, but KKR's success in soaking up all the demand for such funds in Europe and preempting the field stung. Behind the scenes, amid the frenzied bidding for NXP, Freescale, Clear Channel, and Equity Office Properties, Schwartzman and James began crafting their response. This would be an even more groundbreaking deal, an IPO of Blackstone itself. By 2006, the rivalry between Schwartzman and Henry Kravis had passed into legend, perhaps even myth. Was it a deeply personal mano-a-mano thing? or just a run-of-the-mill testosterone-charged competition between Wall Street chieftains, Coke versus Pepsi, with a financial twist. It was clear there was no love lost between them, and no professional camaraderie, but there were partisans of each who claimed their man didn't give the other much thought, and that any melodrama was a creation of the press. After all, their firms collaborated on some of the largest buyouts of the decade, including the data company SunGard, the TV ratings firm VNU Nielsen, and TDC, Denmark's telephone company, and they had teamed up for the unsuccessful bid for Clear Channel. The two men were certainly different in background, temperament, and tastes. Kravis, who had grown up wealthy, was only 3 years older than Schwartzman, but had a decade's head start in the buyout business, and was already fabulously wealthy in his own right by the early 80s, when Schwartzman was a little-known banker at Lehman. KKR's deals had made Kravis an A-list celebrity in the 80s, and with his second wife, the fashion designer Carolyn Rome, on his arm, he had gained entree to New York's elite social circles. He had worked the charity circuit for decades, and his third wife, Marie-Josée Drouin, a Canadian economist and TV personality, made a name for herself hosting dinner parties sprinkled with intellectuals. Kravis seemed comfortable with his position and had retreated from the public eye after the 1980s. Schwartzman still had something to prove. One didn't have to scratch hard to see the antipathy. Schwartzman never missed a chance to put down KKR, as he did when he called it a one-trick pony to Business Week, and he conspicuously neglected to invite Kravis to his birthday party in 2007. While it was hard at times to distinguish between what was a genuine blood feud and what was simply good newspaper copy, there was nonetheless more than a bit of truth to the quip of someone who knows them both, that the psychodynamics of Steve and Henry drove an entire industry. The notion that a major private equity firm would soon go public was in the air by early 2006. The previous December, Art Paponis, a banker at Goldman Sachs, had floated the idea with Schwartzman, but Paponis had tossed out a possible valuation of just $7.5 billion, far less than what Schwartzman had in mind, so that discussion went nowhere. By the spring of 2006, a chorus of bankers was serenading Blackstone with the same tune, and with the momentum of buyouts building, and in the wake of the KKR Amsterdam fundraising, the value the market would put on a business like Blackstone was rising. Michael Klein, a senior Citigroup banker, whose job it was to liaise with buyout firms, brought it up with Schwartzman over lunch at Schwartzman's weekend home in the Hamptons. Klein didn't know how profitable Blackstone was, but he knew that it had roughly $70 billion in assets under management and was in the best niches of the alternative asset management business. It collected both its steady 1.5% management fee, plus 20% of the profits on its biggest funds, buyouts, and real estate, and the investors in those committed their money for up to 10 years. They couldn't cut and run like mutual fund or hedge fund investors if the firm had a rough year or two. It made them decisively more valuable than hedge funds, Klein says. As a rough number, he suggested to Schwartzman that Blackstone might be worth upward of $20 billion, a figure that was much more to Schwartzman's liking. James, meanwhile, was batting around the same ideas in more detail with three senior bankers from Morgan Stanley, Ruth Porat, Edward Pick, and Michael Wise. In 5 brainstorming sessions in May 2006, they debated the merits both of raising a fund like KKR's and of Blackstone itself going public. The benefits of an IPO were clear enough. It would raise money for the firm and allow partners to monetize their stakes, turn them into cash. James pressed the bankers instead to focus on the downsides to going public. Jotting prodigiously on yellow notepads with a can of Diet Dr. Pepper invariably at his side, James conducted a Socratic interrogation of the trio. "Please tell us how bad this could be," was the thrust, says Porat, Morgan Stanley's head banker for financial services clients at the time, and later the bank's chief financial officer. An IPO would make sense only if the price were right, but there was no way James and Schwartzman were going to open up Blackstone's books to Morgan Stanley, not even to Porat, whom James had known for 20 years and had once tried to recruit to DLJ. No one outside the firm, not even rank-and-file Blackstone partners, knew what the firm as a whole made. And Morgan Stanley was a competitor in private equity, real estate investing, and merger advice. James's solution was to give Morgan Stanley some theoretical numbers. "We told them they would be disguised, but representative of the business," James explains. "Then we created a fictional set of numbers that reflected trends, mix, and margins, but did not give absolute levels." Based on the valuations, the bankers came back with, Blackstone would get a sense of what it might be worth without tipping its financial hand. From Morgan Stanley's response, James could see that they would end up not far off Klein's $20 billion figure. Porat heard nothing back after the last meeting and thought perhaps James had cooled on the whole idea. In fact, she and her team had been so enthusiastic about the prospects that in early June, Schwartzman and James summoned Blackstone's CFO, Puglisi, and Robert Friedman, its general counsel, and asked them to figure out what needed to be done to prep the firm to go public. Schwartzman laid out a couple of conditions. Control of Blackstone would have to remain with him and management. He didn't want to upset the system of benign dictatorship that had gotten the firm to this point and had suppressed internal rivalries. "You have to understand where they came from. Lehman," says Puglisi. Second, the IPO would have to be engineered to retain employees and not provide a means for them to cash out and walk away. However the IPO was structured, it also had to be done in a way that didn't subject Blackstone to corporate taxes. Blackstone was organized as a partnership, and partnerships generally don't pay corporate taxes. Instead, their partners pay income tax on their respective shares of the partnership's profits. The top-secret project was dubbed Project Puma, an echo of Project Panther, the aborted bid to list a fund in Amsterdam. Only this small band and a handful of outside advisors would be let in on it. "I was fixated on confidentiality, in large part because I wasn't completely sure I wanted to do this. I wanted to make sure that virtually no one at the firm knew," Schwartzman says. "I didn't want to raise expectations. It could be a diversion." Joshua Ford Bonney, a young IPO specialist at Simpson Thatcher, Blackstone's law firm, was brought in to work on the legal issues, and Deloitte and Touche, Blackstone's audit firm, was consulted. But Blackstone required each individual outside lawyer, accountant, and banker to sign a personal confidentiality agreement, a virtually unprecedented demand. Other partners, even Peterson, would not learn about the plan for months. There was no small irony in the move to take Blackstone public at a time when the firm was playing a starring role in a sweeping privatization of American and European business. But there were powerful reasons for Blackstone itself to move in the opposite direction. While its partners spent their days trying to devise ways to sell the assets Blackstone owned at a profit, they had no way of capturing the value in the business they had built. The issue was particularly acute for Peterson, who turned 80 in 2006. Under his original 1985 agreement with Schwartzman, if one of them died, His estate was entitled to receive income from the firm only for 5 to 7 years. He could not pass on his stake in the firm to heirs, let alone sell it. Allowing the public to buy in would provide a route for Peterson to cash out and would help the firm ease out a founder who was de facto retired, even though he shared 50-50 voting power with Schwartzman and its core businesses and continued to collect a sizable chunk of their profits. Getting Blackstone into some form that could be taken public entailed a Herculean effort by the lawyers and accountants. To begin with, there was no one Blackstone. The firm was a cluster of 100 or so partnerships and corporations and funds with contractual ties and overlapping management and ownership, but no single parent company whose shares could be sold to the public. Control was complicated, too. Peterson and Schwartzman alone had voting rights in the buyout and M&A businesses. They divvied up the profits to the partners in those groups and consulted them, but the other partners had no legal right to a say in management. By contrast, the managers of the real estate arm, including its founder, John Schreiber, who was not even a Blackstone partner or employee, controlled half of the voting rights for that business, with Blackstone holding the other half. To go public, Blackstone would have to create a single entity, and ultimately two entities, at the top of the corporate pyramid. The restructuring posed a thicket of tax, regulatory, accounting, and governance barriers through which Blackstone had to navigate. The firm wanted to list on the New York Stock Exchange, but it did not want to submit to the exchange's rules giving shareholders the right to nominate, elect, and depose directors. On the regulatory front, Blackstone had to be an operating business that took a hands-on role in managing its holdings, so that it would not fall under the onerous regulations governing passive stock market investors, such as mutual fund managers. But for tax purposes, Blackstone wanted to be treated as a passive fund collecting income, so it could avoid paying federal corporate taxes. Going public also raised profound intangible issues. Would it alter the firm's culture and change the incentives for management? Would Blackstone, over time, concentrate more on producing predictable short-term profits for shareholders instead of bigger but less predictable long-term gains for the investors in its funds? Schwartzman and James had many qualms about going public, but they knew that if Goldman, Citi, and Morgan Stanley had talked to them about it, bankers would assuredly be knocking on the doors at KKR, TPG, Apollo, and Carlyle as well. "If we don't do it, someone else will," was the consensus around the table at the first Project Puma meetings, Puglisi recalls. "If someone else does it, everyone will have to follow. That's the law of Wall Street." There was an expectation that all the dominoes would fall, says Morgan Stanley's Porat. Moreover, there were huge benefits to going public. Not only would it allow Peterson, Schwartzman, and other partners to sell down their stakes and diversify their wealth, it would give the firm acquisition currency, stock, with which it could buy other businesses and lure talent. With stock, it could afford to add much larger new businesses than it could if it had to pay in cash or with an illiquid ownership stake in Blackstone. That advantage would soon be demonstrated with GSO Capital, a debt fund manager formed by former colleagues of James's from DLJ. In January 2008, after the IPO, Blackstone agreed to buy GSO, which managed $10 billion in assets, paying for it largely with stock. James also saw other less obvious payoffs. Unlike most of their counterparts at other private equity houses, Blackstone's partners became fully vested in their profit stakes the day an investment was made. If they left the firm the next day, they would still collect their share of any gains when a company was sold years later. An IPO would allow the firm to create incentives for people to stay for the long haul. Under the plan that emerged, partners would receive their new stock in the company over 8 years, forfeiting what they hadn't yet received if they left sooner. James also saw going public as a chance to break down the silos in the organization, the tendency of its units to operate in isolation. Instead of just being paid a share of the profits from their own units, partners would now be awarded stakes in the entire enterprise, binding them together economically. Still, the prospect of being public was daunting. "Everyone was a bit ambivalent," says James. "Do we want to live in a fishbowl? Do we want to disclose net worth and private compensation?" This was a fundamentally different kind of decision than raising a new fund on the stock market as KKR had. To pull off an IPO, management would have to satisfy a multitude of constituencies, the investors in its existing funds, who might worry that the firm's priorities would be altered, the partners, whose financial interests would be completely restructured, as well as potential public investors. A couple of times a week, Steve and I would sit down and say, "Do we really want to do this?" says James. For all his concerns, James was convinced that it made sense for the firm and acted, in Puglisi's words, as the coach and quarterback of the effort. Schwartzman, who would make the final call, reserved judgment through the fall and winter. "I didn't invest myself, personally," Schwartzman says. Although he was involved in the discussions throughout, he wanted to stay objective and to make a balanced decision once all the facts were in. Like prosecutor and judge, James would make the case, and Schwartzman would take it under submission. By the end of the summer of 2006, the lawyers at Simpson Thacher had drafted a plan to reform Blackstone as a master limited partnership, a structure commonly used for oil and investment partnerships. The public investors would be limited partners or unit holders, and the partnership would be managed by a second partnership owned by Blackstone's existing partners. In this form, Blackstone would pay no corporate taxes, and the public unit holders would have few rights. They would have no vote on directors, for instance, and it would be very difficult for them to dislodge management. There was just one problem. Partners would have to swap their share of future profits for equity in the unified Blackstone. To do that would involve estimating the future gains on each investment, because partners had joined at different times and thus were entitled to different slices of the pie. Projecting future investment profits would be a dicey and a monumental exercise, and one potentially fraught with politics, since individual partners might argue that the investments in which they had a stake were more promising than others. James devised an end run around the difficulty. Partners would keep their stakes in most existing investments, and the public company would own only the profits on the most recent investments and those made after the IPO. This bypassed the need to predict the success of older investments, but there was a catch. The firm would have few, if any, investment profits in the first few years after the IPO, as it would take time for current investments to ripen and be harvested. The solution was a new accounting rule, Financial Accounting Standard 159, which allowed firms in some circumstances to book income based on projections of future profits. Each quarter, Blackstone would appraise each investment in its portfolio based on cash flows and values for similar businesses, and using complex financial models, it would calculate the present value of the carried interest, its 20% of the profit, that it was likely to collect down the road. It would be a stupendous feat of theorizing and speculation, but the new accounting rules seemed to authorize it. James did much of the number crunching himself to put the plan together. By October 11th, he had mustered enough information that he called Porat and told her he wanted Morgan Stanley to begin work in earnest on an IPO. One of the bank's primary tasks was to estimate more precisely what price Blackstone could command in the market. This was no small challenge. Investors and stock analysts typically look to comparable companies, but there weren't any public-private equity firms that truly compared. In Britain, there was 3i Group PLC, but it was smaller and focused on mid-sized, not large companies. Then there was Onyx Corporation in Canada, but like 3i, it invested heavily in its own funds, so that buying its shares amounted to taking a stake in an investment fund, whose profits and value could oscillate, rather than a piece of a fund manager whose income and value tended to be more steady. Moreover, Blackstone wasn't just a private equity firm. It had its M&A and restructuring businesses, and its hedge fund of funds business. None of the normal measures for assessing stocks worked well either. Assets under management, the benchmark for mutual fund companies and many other money management firms that derive their income from fixed management fees, wasn't an apt measure for Blackstone because 2/3 of its profits in 2006 were investment gains. Likewise, price earnings multiples, a standard benchmark for stocks, were pretty much meaningless because Blackstone's earnings took unconventional forms and fluctuated so widely quarter to quarter. It would take some ingenuity, then, to make the case for any valuation of the business. Project Puma got an unexpected boost in November 2006 when Fortress Investment Group, a smaller private equity and hedge fund manager, filed papers to go public. Fortress had adopted a parallel legal structure, and its business was similar enough to Blackstone's that it would be a useful trial balloon to gauge which way the market winds were blowing. Through the late fall and winter, the lawyers and accountants ground away on the particulars. By January 2007, the planning was far enough along that Schwartzman finally met with Peterson to inform him of the IPO and to discuss the delicate issue of reducing his stake. It was a measure of how marginalized Peterson had become that 6 months of groundwork had been laid before he was made aware. Though Peterson stood to gain the most from the IPO because he would be able to sell part of his stake, he wasn't keen on the project. I had run a public company, so I knew a lot about what public companies were about, Peterson says. Steve and I must have had a 2-hour discussion one day, and I said, look, I'm about to retire, and while I have the power, under the founder's agreement, to block it, I'm not going to do that. But I am going to insist that you have really thought this thing through, and I'm going to tell you how being public is very different from being private. You're used to the privacy of your compensation and all your arrangements and so forth. You're used to privacy in your private life. You as a CEO will become a center point or lightning rod, and you'll have to become beholden to a board of directors. You're going to have to be meeting endlessly with equity analysts, making investor telephone calls, spending an enormous amount of time. If there happen to be any public problems, you're going to be the focal point. By then, the process was gaining momentum, and Blackstone was ready to bring in a second bank because the offering would be too big for Morgan Stanley to market single-handedly. Adding bankers was more than an exercise in spreading the risk. It was also a division of spoils. The IPO would yield $246 million in fees and commissions for its underwriters, and every major investment bank would want a piece of the action. The first bone was thrown to Michael Klein, the city banker, who had first floated the $20 billion valuation figure the spring before over lunch with Schwartzman. In January, Schwartzman chose Citi to co-lead the IPO with Morgan Stanley. James summoned a team of Citi's capital markets bankers to Blackstone's headquarters on the evening of January 15th, the Monday of the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday weekend, to let them in on the plans and to sign up Citi as an underwriter. Schwartzman and James were still so obsessed with secrecy that they didn't tell Morgan Stanley that Citi had been hired, or vice versa, for several weeks. As leads, each bank would be responsible for selling 20% of the shares, but Morgan Stanley would receive a bigger part of the fees because its bankers had labored for months laying the foundation. As the IPO date drew close, Blackstone repaid favors to other banks that had backed its investments, adding Credit Suisse, Lehman Brothers, and Merrill Lynch & Company, each of which got a 14% slice. Deutsche Bank, which had financed many of Blackstone's LBOs, but did not have the retail brokerage network needed to market large blocks of shares like those in Blackstone's offering, was tacked on at the end after complaining about being left out. It was allocated just 5% of the stock and appeared one symbolic line further down in the list of banks on the cover page. While the IPO preparations were moving ahead in secret, Blackstone was everywhere in the public eye in the first months of 2007. John Gray's real estate team was waging an all-out war for equity office properties in January and February, and in Britain, Blackstone, KKR, TPG, and CVC Capital Partners were pursuing a closely watched $22 billion bid for J. Sainsbury PLC, one of the country's leading supermarket chains, a deal that, had it come to pass, would have set a new buyout record for Europe. Meanwhile, Schwartzman had gone on the conference circuit and had become something of a quote-meister. That January at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, the annual conclave of business, financial, and political leaders from around the globe, he expounded on how executives dreaded the headaches of managing a public company. The CEO of an unnamed $125 billion corporation, he told the audience, was tired of the hassles of answering to the public markets and said to him, "Geez, I wish you could buy us, but we're too big." It was Schwartzman's 60th birthday party on February 13th that elevated him from being one more Wall Street bigwig to a symbol. It transformed him into a cliché for the age and a punching bag. The scale of the bash stunned even jaded Wall Streeters, and to the man in the street, the extravagance reinforced every negative stereotype of financiers. It was the reality version of Bonfire of the Vanities, and the press had a field day, for the event encapsulated the power and wealth of private equity and of the small band of men who controlled its biggest firms. The potential political fallout from the party worried Henry Silverman, the ex-Blackstone partner who had left to run Cendant. He says he bluntly asked Schwartzman, "Why would you do this?" Silverman was involved in a business group that lobbied in Washington, and he knew that there were people in Congress who were looking at ways to raise taxes on hedge fund and private equity partners. I said to Steve, "This is a very bad idea, because these guys read the newspapers also." It wasn't just the party. In the month that followed, Schwartzman continued on what seemed from the outside like an orgy of self-promotion. Just a week after the party, a cover story in Fortune dubbed him the new King of Wall Street. Arms crossed, poker-faced, in his trademark blue-striped shirt with white collar and a navy pinstripe suit, Schwartzman looked every inch the master of the universe. "Steve Schwartzman of Blackstone wants to buy your company and has a $125 billion war chest to do it," the subhead read. A few weeks later, on March 16th, Schwartzman showed up on CNBC in a lengthy interview with the network's glamorous anchor, Maria Bartiromo. Some of the press coverage was a fluke. Fortune had compiled a package of stories about private equity and whipped out the profile of Schwartzman at the last minute without his knowledge, relying on a stock photo for the cover. But in the wake of the party, the exposure had made Schwartzman the very public face of the high-rolling world of leveraged buyouts. Going into February, Schwartzman still hadn't given the final go-ahead for the IPO. The very last thing we wanted to do was file the papers to go public and then change our minds, James says. You get all the negatives of being public and none of the positives. They didn't want to launch an IPO until we were absolutely sure we could complete it. When Fortress went public on February 9th, it became clear that Blackstone's plan was viable. Fortress priced its shares at $18.50 at the top of the estimated range, and they more than doubled on their first day of trading, hitting $38 at one point. Not only did they get public, but they got public with great success, with great fanfare and a great valuation, says James. Now there was a sense of urgency, for Schwartzman and James had learned that KKR had designs to go public, and there were rumblings that TPG had sought out bankers for advice. They also were concerned that the window of opportunity might slam shut. Steve and I both instinctively felt that the public markets are inherently flighty, says James. The publicity from the steadily escalating wave of buyouts unveiled that spring was bound to help, conveying that private equity was on a tear. On February 26th, KKR and TPG announced they would buy TXU Corporation, a Texas electricity and gas utility, for $48 billion, eclipsing the record Blackstone had set just weeks earlier when it closed the buyout of Equity Office Properties. 3 days later, KKR clinched the largest LBO ever in Europe, an $18.5 billion takeover of the publicly traded drugstore chain Alliance Boots PLC. By then, a number of other partners had been consulted about Blackstone's IPO, or had caught wind of it, but Schwartzman and James still hadn't officially informed rank-and-file partners when CNBC broke the news on TV on March 16th. That Blackstone would soon file offering papers, the first leak since the planning had begun more than 9 months earlier. 3 days later, Schwartzman and James convened partners in the 31st floor conference room at Blackstone's headquarters, with partners in other offices beamed in on video monitors to explain the IPO and the restructuring that would precede it. On March 22nd, Blackstone made it official, lodging a draft prospectus with the Securities and Exchange Commission for an offering that could raise up to $4 billion. The 363-page document was long on words, but short on the kinds of juicy details others really wanted to know, such as how much Peterson, Schwartzman, and James made, and what their stakes in the firm were. Under SEC rules, details like that do not have to be disclosed until later in the months-long process of going public. The 33 pages of financial statements were exceedingly opaque, if not perverse. A summary showed $2.3 billion of net income, profit in lay terms, but just $1.12 billion in revenue. How could that be? It made more than it took in? One had to burrow 29 pages into the financials to find a line showing $1.55 billion in investment gains that fell outside the definition of revenue. Once the prospectus was on file, the SEC's quiet period rules kicked in, and Schwartzman and others at the firm were barred from giving interviews. It should have been smoother sailing. A but the project instead lurched forward and back as a succession of out-of-the-blue events caught Schwartzman, James, and the rest of Blackstone off guard. The first was utterly fortuitous. Through friends, Anthony Lee Young, the newly hired head of the firm's Asian operations and Hong Kong's former finance minister, contacted the managers of a new Chinese government sovereign wealth fund that was being formed to invest the billions of surplus dollars China was accumulating because of its yawning trade deficit with the West. Leung had in mind that the fund might buy a few Blackstone shares, but the managers of the new fund, later named China Investment Corporation, or CIC, instead expressed interest in buying a major stake. Schwartzman wasn't sure at first if the offer was worth the potential complication and delay of negotiating a side deal, but the Chinese offered to invest $3 billion, and their terms turned out to be simple. All they wanted was the chance to buy in without paying the investment bank's fees and commissions. They didn't seek any special access to information beforehand or a seat on Blackstone's board, and they agreed to keep the stake under 10% so that the investment didn't have to go through a national security review in the United States. In addition, their shares would be non-voting. On May 20th, barely 3 weeks after Leung first spoke to CIC's head, Liu Zhiwei, on April 30th, a deal was signed for CIC to invest through a subsidiary optimistically named Beijing Wonderful Investments Limited. One person familiar with CIC calculated that in those 3 weeks of talks, China accumulated $15 billion in new reserves, and so he figured that its managers were just too busy putting out their money to haggle. For Blackstone, the investment was a huge coup. The firm was several years behind competitors like Carlyle, KKR, and TPG, developing its business in Asia. Now it had won the imprimatur of the Chinese government without any real strings attached, a link that promised to give it the inside track on many investment opportunities in China. The investment solved another problem as well: how to cash out Peterson. Up to then, the banks had figured that $4 billion was toward the upper limit of what Blackstone could raise in the IPO, based on investor demand, and much of that money would go into the firm's coffers rather than partners' pockets. With the additional $3 billion from the Chinese, Blackstone would be able to sell 75% more shares than it had first planned, enough to allow Peterson and other partners to sell much bigger portions of their holdings. Now Blackstone would sell nearly $7.6 billion of stock, and almost $4.6 billion of that would go to partners. In exchange for Peterson selling a higher proportion of his stake than other partners, James asked him to cut his equity stake ahead of the IPO. Peterson's son, a banker, negotiated the terms, and after some back and forth, they agreed he would give up 15% of his holding. "I said I wanted to be able to look my partners in the eye," Peterson says. "What I get in liquidity, they don't get." After he unloaded shares in the IPO, Peterson's stake in the firm would drop to 4.2%, and he confirmed that he would formally retire from Blackstone at the end of 2008. Schwartzman would be left with 23.3%, James with 4.9%. The other surprises were not as auspicious as the Chinese overture. While Blackstone was negotiating with the Chinese, the staff at the SEC, which vets prospectuses and the financial statements in them, was raising objections to Blackstone's quirky method of booking income based on projections of future profits. Blackstone's bankers had never been enthusiastic about the idea because they thought it would be hard to explain to investors. Now the regulators thought it was too clever by half and threatened to nix the idea. Just when the hard work of getting the initial IPO prospectus on file with all the financials was complete, James